The Minnesota Court of Appeals is now in session. Judge Frisch, Judge Johnson, Judge Shellhaus, Honorable Jennifer Frisch presiding. Our case today is A19-1886, State of Minnesota versus Tyler Ray Pauley.
Good morning, counsel. Welcome to the Minnesota Court of Appeals. Today is September 24, 2020. This is the second of two cases on our oral argument calendar. We are in a new world. I'm going to ask that you mute your microphone if you are not speaking. The marshal will show the running clock of your time. Each party will have 15 minutes for their primary argument. The appellant will have an additional 5 minutes for rebuttal. Before speaking, I ask that you identify yourself and your client. And with that, counsel, you may proceed.
Good morning. My name is Laura Heinrich, and I represent Tyler Pauley. The district court erred twice in this case. First, it erred in finding that Mr. Pauley did not have a reasonable expectation of privacy in his Dropbox account and his property therein. The district court found that Mr. Pauley had a subjective expectation of privacy in his Dropbox account, but it was objectively unreasonable because the Dropbox terms of service included language that prohibited the storage of contraband and that Dropbox may search Mr. Pauley's account and turn over information to law enforcement when necessary. The district court did not include any references to other provisions of the terms of service, including guarantees that Dropbox would keep the information in an account as if it were as private as on the account holder's personal computer. Second, the district court erred in finding that the private search doctrine applied, where the state had failed to present any evidence of why or how Dropbox employees searched Mr. Pauley's files. Specifically, the district court held that Mr. Pauley no longer had any constitutionally protected privacy interest against government searches of his belongings because a Dropbox employee had searched Mr. Pauley's account and his files for a private purpose. The state, however, only presented attorney representations from Dropbox that were not based on personal knowledge and therefore were not evidence. This court must reverse.
Counsel, why does that actually matter? I mean, the way that I read the record is that Dropbox conducted the search and then delivered on its own accord material to the investigative agency. Why does the investigative agency have to avert its eyes upon receipt of the contraband?
The investigative agency, and are you referring first to the National Center for Missing and Exploited Children? Because that's what's
We can start there, and then it's sent to the state.
The Minnesota Bureau of Criminal Apprehension. Right. The issue here is that if you have a privacy interest like Mr. Pauley does in his Dropbox account, and there is there's no warrant, it is a search of his things that are sent over to a law enforcement agency. It's not clear from this record with what the state presented if this is contraband on its face. They had to actually open these files that are provided. So there is, in some ways, a second search that happens in the opening of any of these files or the playing of any video. And it is the state's obligation as the party that is attempting to introduce these exhibits at trial to prove their case to show that at every point it was lawfully obtained. If there is our contention is there is a Fourth Amendment and Article 1, Section 10 privacy interest, and government actors are opening his things without a search warrant, they have to show that it was provided to them, looked at, and that same opening happened by a private entity before there wouldn't still be a privacy interest that controls at the point that it's provided to the NCMEC or to the BCA. Did that answer the question?
I'm still not, I mean, the search itself of Mr. Pauley's account, Dropbox account was not conducted by, the initial search was not conducted by a government agent, correct? It was conducted by Dropbox, which is a private entity.
Correct. The state failed to create a record of how it was searched, but we do know that it was searched and that it was then in accordance with federal law provided to NCMEC through a tip line.
So what I'm trying to understand is why does it run afoul of Fourth Amendment principles when the private agency is the one delivering the material that it searched to the government? Why does the government have to say, I'm not going to look at this now?
So
when there's a representation that it is contraband.
There's still a second search and opening it. So it's provided to them. It's like in Jacobson, or if you look at sort of the other cases that are cited in Jacobson, when there's like a video, for instance, playing the video, putting it in and watching it was considered an expansion of the scope of the search. So if you're going to open it and play it and watch these videos, there needs to be some record of how the private entity had done exactly the same thing, opened it, played it, watched it, that the search that NCMEC is doing secondarily is the same as the search that happened however Dropbox employees had looked at it. Again, the state didn't provide a record of whether Dropbox employees watched it, if it was a hash value search, or exactly what was done, because there were actually no records of what happened with Mr. Polly's account, at least that we're aware of.
What's the principled basis for that? I mean, I get that there's a circuit split. I get that we haven't spoken on this in Minnesota, but I'd like to know what is the principled basis that it has to be an exact one-for-one search when it's represented that the material is contraband?
This is no different than any other type of private search doctrine case. So for instance, if you look at the facts of Jacobson, you have postal employees or private entity looking at the drugs, and it looks on its face to be drugs.
But then it tests them. It does something more than what the private search was. So there is some, it's not a one-for-one search.
Right, it's a minimal intrusion versus the—
So why is it not a minimal intrusion to actually open the attachment that's delivered? Just like opening the material that's delivered.
That I apologize that the case name is evading me now, but the case that's also cited with Jacobson is a case where they're provided videos, and this is more like a case where you're provided videos, and watching the video is considered an expansion of the scope of the search. So that's what we have here, is they're watching a video. It comes in some form of JPEG, PDF attachment. Again, the state didn't provide a record of exactly how it was provided, but the representation that it's contraband is not enough. They have to actually watch it through. And again, the record would need to be clear that somebody at Dropbox actually watched the video through for then the secondary watch to be concurrent. That's the difference between sort of the drugs in Jacobson versus the other case, which I will, in my time on rebuttal, I will cite to. Watching the video is a further incursion, is a secondary search, and expands the scope of the search.
Well, counsel, your client voluntarily put these items that are at question here into his Dropbox account. What law suggests, given the terms of service with Dropbox, that your counsel had a reasonable expectation of privacy? I mean, don't we need to start there? And isn't it your client's burden of proof to show that he had a reasonable expectation of privacy with respect to this private account under private terms of service?
It's a two-part inquiry. The first part is whether Mr. Polly had a subjective expectation of privacy, and that would be his burden. But the second part about whether it's reasonable under the case law would be the state's burden. Here, I apologize, I don't mean, you look
no,
like you're
go ahead.
To speak. Okay. Here we have, this isn't new or novel in the sense that a online storage account is just like having a storage shed, a storage locker, you rent an apartment. These are all places with lease agreements that are similar to the terms of service that you see from Dropbox, where you are leasing a space, you're allowed to keep your things there, people have an expectation of privacy that when you're leasing a space to store your things, that they're going to remain private. The difference between sort of an online versus in the real world sort of physical spaces is that every online account has a lease. There's no such thing as like an owned space that's truly private. There's always some type of service or some type of maintenance that needs to be done because it's digital.
Just to interrupt, isn't this actually different from a storage unit or a fish house, for example, because every account like this is subject to the federal law that requires the service provider, if it becomes aware of any apparent child pornography, to send that to the National Center for Missing and Exploited Children. And your typical storage unit and fish house or what have you, leased property like that, isn't subject to a national federal law like this that requires disclosure.
Well, that does one of two things. One, if the law is being interpreted to require the internet service providers to actually be actively searching regularly for pornography, I think that actually turns the internet service provider into a government actor.
But I think that in our case, there's no, I don't think anybody has suggested that Dropbox had a legal obligation to monitor and to send this information to the National Center. But pursuant to the terms of service, it had the right to monitor. And in any event, however it might inadvertently come across knowledge apparent knowledge that there was apparent child pornography, it then had the duty to send that information to the National Center. I understand where you're going with the other argument, but those aren't the facts here. I don't think there's been any suggestion that Dropbox had a duty to monitor.
No, and in the brief, I apologize. In the brief, I didn't argue it in that way. I think that the statute is written that if it becomes aware to the internet service provider, they do have a duty to disclose to NCMEC. If they don't, they face criminal penalties. However, there's no lease provision for any physical space that says you are allowed to do illegal things here. It's whether or not the space itself is private, and the space itself is private, and in the sense that, yes, there are some specific things that say that you are not allowed to do certain things, but they then follow that part of the terms of service with an express guarantee. The sentence after the part about we may search and turn it over says, we treat your stuff as your stuff, and it's as private as if it were on your personal computer at home. No person is going to think that the stuff that they store on their personal computer at home doesn't have a protected privacy interest. At best, the terms of service here are ambiguous because they provide both. They provide explanations of the types of conduct that you're not supposed to do that they may monitor, but they may not. They're under no obligation to do so. If they think they need to disclose, they may. But on the other hand, they're also saying that this is supposed to be as private as if it was on your computer, that your stuff is yours. You get to determine what you do with it. It's password protected. You determine who to share it with. They're not allowed to use it. That is throughout the terms of service.
But it's also throughout the terms of service that the users of a Dropbox account must comply, must, that's the word that's used in the terms of service, comply with the acceptable use policy. And I don't think there's any question that the storage of the type of contraband that we're talking about is not in compliance with the acceptable use policy. Right?
Correct. But the acceptable use policy also is long and not, it's not a list that is conclusive. It sort of leaves things open. So to say that you are meant to know everything you're supposed to comply with based on these terms of service is still ambiguous. And most of the things that you're meant to comply with in terms of the acceptable use policy are that you're not allowed to undermine the services that Dropbox provides to its account holders. You can't circumvent storage unit space. You can't try to sell or use their products for other people. It's essentially protecting their own business interests, not about regulating all of the behavior that happens within an account. Again, I think that taking one sentence out of what is otherwise a policy that is really geared at making the account holder feel as if their information is protected and secure, and this is a place where they can keep their protected and secure information, it doesn't do justice to the overall feel and express promises of Dropbox that their information is being held private, won't be disclosed, and that it's yours. And it's not just individuals who use Dropbox. There's also businesses that use Dropbox. There's an expectation that everything in there is private and they can trust this company to keep their things secure. It's an external storage in many ways and something they could use to share or to just protect. So even if there is that one sentence, it has to be read as a whole. And the other is that to have Mr. Pauly's expectation of privacy depend on what is legalese and complicated sort of contract law would undermine sort of guarantees of the Fourth Amendment generally, because the terms of every single lease provision would determine whether or not you had a Fourth Amendment protection. And right, my time has expired.
Thank you, Counsel.
Yeah,
go ahead, Counsel.
I have a few questions that I've been refraining from asking so as not to interfere with the valuable questions and answers so far. But if I may. Ms. Heinrich, I have a question about the evidentiary record. I mean, I see in the record documents consisting of emails between defense trial counsel and Dropbox's counsel. I also see a two-page document on Dropbox stationery that has numbered paragraphs that seems to state some general procedures. I mean, I think you've made arguments about why that evidence is not as strong as other evidence, but it is in the record, correct?
It is in the record. I would argue, as I have in the brief and was argued at the district court, it's not evidence. It is in the record.
What do you mean? Why do you say it's not evidence?
I failed to find a single case that said attorney representations that are not based on personal knowledge can act as evidence. This is correspondence between an attorney who's making representations that they had to go and like ask other people.
I mean, representations, isn't that case law focused on representations by counsel of record who represent parties in the case?
I don't see a principled distinction between the two. These wouldn't be fact witnesses. If they were to be called in to testify, they would say they don't have personal knowledge. It would be hearsay. And some of the information that was provided was actually the state summary of a conversation they had with counsel.
I believe that was defense counsel's summary, that one page write up. It says JDS at the end.
There's also one from Ms. Wanta in the last filing that it had with district court, which is a summary.
I mean, these were submitted as exhibits to affidavits in motion practice, right?
They were not affidavits. I think they really were just summaries of conversations. It's a double hearsay. My sense is that trial counsel was attempting to give Judge Heilden an update on what they were doing, because Judge Heilden, as is throughout the record, had asked over and over again, please create more of an evidentiary record so I can make these decisions. And there's over 2 years of the state saying that they're going to try to find the right witnesses, have subpoenas, bring people in. And instead we just have representations of counsel.
So one of the issues with respect to the private search doctrine is whether, I guess, using my own, maybe I'm restating it, but whether the first search by a government, a state actor, was not more extensive than the private search that preceded it. And I know there's case law, perhaps making a distinction between the hash method and otherwise. But in this two-page Dropbox document, paragraph 4 says, when Dropbox indicates in a cyber tip line report that a file was, quote, reviewed by company, end quote, Dropbox is referring to a review of that image/video by a human reviewer prior to making the report. If we accept that at face value, doesn't that indicate then that the private search was not less extensive than the search done by the National Center after the referral?
again, not conceding that that is evidence, but to follow through with your question, we also have in the same representations from counsel from Dropbox that they don't have any files of what happened in Mr. Polly's case. The only thing that was that they have is they sent in the tip line, which is essentially checking it, tip line report, which is essentially checking a number of boxes. So I still don't think in saying generally our policy is that we have humans review things is enough to say that in this particular case that it happened, they would need to produce some type of evidence that it happened here. They said they threw away the records. They don't have any records. There's nobody that could testify to what happened exactly here, which I think is a problem for the state.
Don't we have a document indicating with respect to each of the 63 electronic files that each was reviewed by company, end quote?
That's the tip line report. It does have a box checked that it was reviewed by company, but that's right. All.
And then this two-page Dropbox document tells us what that means. That means reviewed by a human reviewer.
I still think the record is unclear. If the state is relying on the scope of the search from Dropbox, there would need to be the policy in place at the time of the search. Again, we have at least part of the record, the amicus brief that Dropbox filed in Ackerman, which is what defense counsel's first raising of the issue was based on, is that Dropbox had filed with a number of other tech companies that use hash value searching regularly as a tool because it would be almost impossible for a human being to be consistently monitoring, looking at everybody's files when there's such big storage, that Dropbox is presenting in that amicus brief that they're using hash value searching. So in terms of the timeline, when they change their policy, if there's a change in policy, the first questions that were asked to counsel from Dropbox were they didn't know if they were using hash value searching at that point. The record, if we were to treat the attorney representations as evidence, which again, I'm not conceding that it is, there's still ambiguity within the record of what the scope of the search was in this particular case.
Thank you, Judge Frisch.
All right, thank you. Anything else from the panel? Thank you, counsel. You'll have 5 minutes for rebuttal.
Thank you.
Counsel, you may proceed as soon as we get the marsh. There we go.
May it please the court. Counsel, good morning. My name is Peter Magnuson. I'm an assistant attorney general, and I represent the respondent state of Minnesota. Both the issues identified by appellant are fact questions for the district court to decide. So to prevail, appellant must show that the district court was clearly erroneous. And with respect to the private search part of it, appellant hasn't met that standard. A fact determination is not clearly erroneous if there is evidence in the record that supports it. And here there is evidence in the record that supports both of the district court's findings. With respect, the critical issue here is the private search. As the Supreme Court stated in Buswell, no matter how egregious the conduct of Gately in making these searches, the contraband was properly admitted into evidence if at the time he enjoyed the status of a private citizen. That's on page 617 of the Buswell case. So did the Dropbox employee enjoy the status of a private citizen at the time? There's no evidence indicating that that person did not. And there's been a lot of discussion about the second prong, but there's been absolutely no discussion about the first prong of that test, whether the state knew or acquiesced in the search before it took place. And there's absolutely no evidence indicating that anyone at NCMEC or anyone at the BCA had any knowledge that Dropbox was going to search appellant's Dropbox account. So if that first prong is not met, we don't even go to the second prong. And there's simply no evidence, and there's been no argument made by appellant indicating that the state had that prior knowledge and acquiesced in the search. So we don't even have to get to the second prong and these other issues unless that first prong is first met, and it hasn't been met here. I just want to address a couple of other things. Counsel argued that according to the terms of service, that can be read as saying your stuff is yours, but the terms of service clearly state, and it's in the addendum in the district court's order, and I refer to it on page 14 of my brief. The acceptable use policy states, quote, you must not even try to do any of the following in connection with the services, close quote. And that also includes publish or share materials that are unlawfully pornographic or indecent. There's no claim here that when these pictures were posted that appellant had no idea or was unaware that they were child pornography. So he knew that he was violating the acceptable use terms when he posted those to his Dropbox account. The terms of service clearly state that Dropbox can monitor your conduct and your content. So yes,
Counsel, can we talk about the private search doctrine?
Sure.
So there's obviously a circuit split here about whether the search conducted by a private entity, once it's delivered to the government, whether the search by the government that thereafter occurs has to be identical to the search that was conducted by the private entity. And some circuits say that it doesn't have to be an exact one-for-one search, and some circuits say it does have to be an exact one-for-one search. What is the position of the state and why?
Well, the case relied upon by appellant for this is the United States versus Ackerman case, from 2016 out of the 10th Circuit. And as I point out in my brief, the facts in that case are clearly distinguishable from what happened here. There, an email was intercepted. It wasn't just shunted through the system and searched as it went by. It was physically intercepted. The AOL people did not search that. Later, NCMEC did after they got the report that the images that were attached to the email contained child pornography. We don't have that here. Nothing was intercepted. Nothing was taken from appellant's Dropbox account. As far as the contents of the Dropbox account, I'm unaware that there is any evidence that those contents were changed in any form or fashion.
So is your position that there was a one-to-one search here?
Yes, as Ackerman itself says, a hashtag search. There are two searches here. There are two possibilities of a search here. Either it was a personal search, which the as Judge Johnson referenced in the record, there's on the NCMEC report, it does state that the contents were personally reviewed. So either there was a personal review or there was a hashtag value search. And even Ackerman notes that if there is a hashtag match, it's virtually impossible for it not to match. It is considered to be a digital fingerprint. And if that digital fingerprint matches, then under Jacobson, any other search that the state did was merely confirmatory, and I don't think it changes that.
So is your position that we don't have to side one way or the other with the differing interpretations of the law, but instead we can assume that the more stringent interpretation of the private search doctrine applies and there was actually a one-to-one search here?
Again, it's a clearly erroneous standard, and the evidence that's in the record here indicates that it was viewed by a Dropbox employee. If that evidence wasn't in the record, then it wouldn't support the district court's finding. But that evidence is in the record, apart from any representations made by Dropbox's counsel. That is in the record, and it does support the district court's determination that the files were viewed by a Dropbox employee. So under the clearly erroneous standard, that finding survives.
Mr. Magnuson, was Ackerman the case in which the ISP looked at only one of four attachments to an email, but yet forwarded all of the attachments. I may be confusing it with a different case. I've read a lot of these cases and so on. But was that also part of the reasoning in Ackerman? And I guess, I'm guessing you know the case law better than I, so that's why I can, of course, reread it, but I'm just wondering if you know.
I recall that there were four attachments to the email. The email and the attachments were intercepted. I don't recall off the top of my head how many, if one, two, three, or four of them were viewed. But Ackerman, the turning point was that law enforcement, after they received the tip line report, they didn't just look at the contents of the attachments. They actually opened the physical email and looked at what was inside the email. And the 10th Circuit determined that that exceeded the scope because there was no question that AOL did not open that email. So that was the turning point of Ackerman, is that the government exceeded the search of AOL when it looked at the email, not necessarily the contents of the images that were attached to the email.
I think one of the important issues in the appeal is burden of proof. And there seems to be some daylight between the parties' positions. Appellant says that this is a matter of an exception to the warrant requirement. You say it's not that, it's whether, well, you say something else. I should let you restate it. But I guess it would be helpful to the court to have more case law to rely on to determine who has the burden of proof in this type of issue.
Well, I've not found any case law that directly talks about the burden of proof with respect to the private search doctrine, which is the crux of the argument here. But again, that passage that I quoted from Buswell, if at the time he enjoyed the status of a private citizen, sounds to me like it's almost a presumption that that a private person who's not a government employee has that status, and that needs to be, that presumption needs to be overcome. I don't see how that burden would be placed on the state to overcome that. The critical question is, as later goes on in Buswell, the critical issue is whether a private party should be deemed an agent or instrument of the government for Fourth Amendment purposes, and that necessarily turns on the degree of the government's participation in the private party's activities. So I don't know who has the burden on establishing that, but it's a totality of the circumstances test that involves a review of all of the evidence. And I think this case can be determined without expressly coming down with a burden of proof here. There's simply no evidence at all that indicates that the state had any knowledge or acquiesced in the search prior to it taking place under the first prong. Therefore, we don't even get to the second prong.
I recall an argument in appellant's brief having to do with the purpose of the private party's search. Is it necessary for the district court or for this court to determine what Dropbox's purpose actually was?
That's essentially the second prong of the private party doctrine. Both prongs have to be satisfied in order for the private party doctrine to not apply. So
can you restate prong? Can you please restate the second prong? You mentioned it earlier, but it would help to hear it again.
One, whether the government knew of and acquiesced in the search, and two, whether the search was conducted to assist law enforcement efforts or to further the private party's own ends. And that I'm quoting that from Buswell at page 618. So appellant's argument focuses on that second prong, whether the search was to further Dropbox's own ends as opposed to the government's ends. If there are no other questions, I would ask the court to find that the district court's findings were not clearly erroneous, and based on those findings, that the district court's order should be affirmed and the convictions as well. Thank you.
Anything else from the panel today? All right, thank you very much, counsel. Counsel, you'll have 5 minutes for rebuttal. One moment while the marshal resets the clock, please. Go ahead, counsel.
Thank you. I wanted to clear up a couple of things that came up in counsel's argument. First, referring to the private search doctrine with these two prongs, it's a little confusing. Within whether it's a private entity, there's actually two prongs that have to be answered. First, was the government aware that this person or this entity was searching? And second, what was the purpose of the search? But the overall private search doctrine actually has two prongs itself. First, was it searched by a private party? So the two prongs that would be decided within whether it's a private party. And then secondly, what was the scope of that search? And that scope of the search matters a lot because the state actor is limited to the scope of the search of the private party. Because the purpose behind the private search doctrine as an exception to the Fourth Amendment is that whatever private interest that you had has already been revealed. So because it's already been revealed, there's no additional privacy interest that's being exposed when the state looks at it. But if it hasn't already been revealed, the scope of the search, then any additional search, there's still a privacy interest that is being revealed by additional government search that goes beyond that scope. So I wanted to make that part clear because I think it was getting a little confusing. And I would direct the court to look at Jorgensen and the language in Jorgensen. The second issue I wanted to address is this idea of a circuit split. The circuit split isn't about whether or not the state has to limit its search to the scope of the private search. The circuit split seems to be over about what information is revealed in hashtag value searching. Whether hashtag value searching is the same as looking at it with your naked eye as a human being, or whether it's more limited. And Ackerman, as well as Keith, which is cited in our brief, which is the 11th Circuit and is written by Gorsch, is saying that there is a difference, that when you open something and look at it physically with your eye, that's a more extensive search that goes beyond the hash value search. Sort of like the idea of having a dog sniff, search to then look at something, you see additional information. It would be kind of the same there versus the 9th Circuit, which is not really cited in our briefs, or the 6th Circuit, which is cited in, or 5th Circuit that is cited in the state's brief. They're saying that hash value searching does in fact rise to the same level of whether or not, or same level of a human being looking at it. And that's what the circuit split is, not whether the state search has to be the same scope as the private search. At least that's the way I read the cases. I would also note that the state continued to say that these were personally reviewed. What's ticked off in the tip line report is that the company looked at the files, but it does not say how they were looked at. That again is still not in the record. The state did not provide that in the record.
Why does that make a difference? I mean, the company looked at the files, they looked at the files.
The scope of the review is what matters, because that's what limits.
They opened it and they saw it was child pornography and then they turned it off versus they watched the whole movie? I mean, do they have to watch the whole movie?
I would argue yes, it has. I mean, these are exceptions to the state having to get a search warrant. Dropbox could have just called the police. The police could have gone and sought a search warrant based on that information. The information has to be that everything has been looked at. So if the state were to look at it after the fact, that they're not revealing any additional information. This is cutting the judiciary out of the review process, which is an important part of the process. I would also wanted to address—
Ms. Heinrich, you say they could have called the police. I mean, isn't it true that they were required by federal statute to make a referral to the National Center?
They have to, if there's any apparent child pornography, they do have to use the tip line. which ultimately is in many ways reporting it to the police. At the point that the NCMC received it, they could have sought a search warrant. I mean, they're treated as government actors because they're such an integral part of prosecution and work with prosecutors' offices and law enforcement. It's really not a difficult step. If you have information from a hash value search or a report from a company, we'd have to go and get a search warrant to then do a more extensive search or go inside of the person's account or have a chance to open and look at everything if you don't already have in the record that they've looked at everything.
But doesn't the state have probable cause to get a search warrant based on the tip from Dropbox? I mean, regardless of the extent of the search, they've been identified as containing contraband. Wouldn't that be enough to substantiate a probable cause determination to get a search warrant?
It could be. It depends on what drop. I see that my time is,
has elapsed.
If I could finish.
Yes, please.
It depends on what Dropbox did, which is why not having this record is so problematic. If Dropbox opened everything, looked at everything, said this is what it is.
What if they just opened one thing?
That might be enough. They could have just received a phone call from somebody. In fact, there is some suggestion from the representations of counsel that often they search only after they received outside information mm-hmm. that there might be child pornography. And at that point, there would likely be enough for a search warrant, but that step is not unimportant. It's really important to have the judiciary make a determination of whether they've established probable cause. And that depends on what type of searching, what type of information Dropbox had. And they're not providing it in the tip line report. They are just clicking boxes. They're not even keeping their own files. I mean, this is a sort of situation where having the judiciary have a chance to look at it, to decide whether they established probable cause, have they done a hash value search, have they looked at everything, what other information they have, is an important step. And it may be that in most situations that there's been extensive enough of a search, hash value search may turn out to be like a dog sniff, or that's probably enough to get a search warrant. But that step of getting a search warrant is important. And ultimately the district court's holding that there isn't any Fourth Amendment privacy interest, that this would happen in every single situation where there's a tip line that's provided, there's going to be some suggestion that the company has looked at it, would mean that no one ever had any privacy right in anything that's online ever. It would be that the state could actually just go in and look at your stuff without it ever going in front of the judiciary. That's ultimately the conclusion of this, of the district court's holding. And that's why we ask you to reverse.
All right. Anything else from the panel this morning? All right. Counsel, thank you so much. This was a well-briefed and argued matter, and we will take the matter under advisement, issue an opinion within the statutory time period. Stay safe and well. Thank you for your cooperation. We are in recess. Thank you.